Last case on our calendar is 06-2331, Disciplinary Counsel versus Lauren Jonathan Margolis. Mr. Koblenz.
Yes, may it please the court, my name is Richard S. Koblenz, and I have the honor of representing Lauren Margolis, who happens to be at the trial table today. I was just thinking, I argued my first case before this court some 29 years ago, and this is the first time I've had an opportunity to have a client actually come and attend an argument with me, and I'm very pleased that he was able to come down and join us today. Your Honors, basically we are here, and this is a very strange situation for me. If somebody would have told me when we entered the stipulations with disciplinary counsel that we would be here objecting, I would have thought that that wasn't true. Excuse me, by the way, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. That would be agreeable with the court. The thing I would like to stress here is that it is the duty of this court to conduct a de novo review of the entire record here in coming to a decision. Quite frankly, it is our opinion, and our merit brief shows this, that we just think the panel just flat didn't pay attention to the evidence in making its findings and coming to the conclusions that it came to. The record just simply, by any review, does not support the findings by the panel relative to aggravation. We have a finding here that Mr. Margolis did not exhibit remorse. Well, if you look at the plea transcript, which was stipulated and is part of this record, if you look at all of the other information that was given, that just isn't true. We have a situation where the United States government moved for downward departure for acceptance of responsibility in this case. And then the government goes one step further according to the plea agreement. They move for additional departure under the federal sentencing guidelines over and above the acceptance of responsibility reduction in points, indicating that in the minds of the prosecutors, who in all candor lived with this case for years, believed that Mr. Margolis had shown the appropriate acceptance of responsibility and contrition for his acts. In fact, the record displays that Mr. Margolis, even though his entire sentence has been completed, is still cooperating with the United States Attorney and working with them relative to their investigation of the antitrust situation in the scrap metal business. In addition to that, the United States Probation Department conducted an exhaustive review and found that Mr. Margolis merited acceptance of responsibility and showed contrition. Judge Nugent sentenced Mr. Margolis, and again, you have the transcript, it's part of the record, it was part of the stipulation, to the lowest sentence possible under the plea agreement, and in fact, he even indicated that he was bound by the plea agreement, he couldn't go any lower. So the government even objected to that, and Judge Nugent, looking at everything, having had the opportunity to speak to Lauren, believed that that was appropriate. Then Judge Nugent, under the law, our government is required to have post-release control. Once again, showing the contrition and the responsibility taken by Mr. Margolis, Judge Nugent reduced for good cause the entire supervised release period that Mr. Margolis was to serve at the conclusion of his home detention sentence. So as soon as that home detention sentence was ended, Mr. Margolis' supervised release requirement was terminated by the court, and there was no supervised release. Once again, that judgment entry was part of the record. Mr. Margolis holds a license as a real estate broker, and like he did with the disciplinary counsel and the legal system, prior to technically being convicted, before sentencing, Mr. Margolis self-reported himself to the real estate board. In a similar vein, Mr. Margolis also self-reported himself to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, and in fact, meetings took place long before he went to serve his term of incarceration with Ms. Costa and Mr. Coghlan relative to the stipulations entered into in this matter. The real estate board had all the same information that was presented to this panel and to the board, and the real estate board of the Department of Commerce, recognizing all of the facts here, issued a public reprimand relative to Lauren Margolis's real estate.
All those, you made a strong argument, obviously, for certain mitigation or reasons that we should enter a public reprimand, but he pled guilty to two felony counts in federal
Absolutely,
court.
Your Honor.
Isn't that in itself, that public reprimand, without everything else, without how, you know, considering that he's cooperating and he's been compliant and so forth, without anything else, it would seem to me the public reprimand for pleading guilty to two felony counts in federal court would be not a good message to send.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree with you. I'm not asking for a public reprimand. What we're asking for is credit for time served.
Well, right.
Our request, I'm just pointing out the real estate board issued a public reprimand.
He would, if we gave him credit for time served, he would serve pretty August, I guess, until August, wouldn't it?
The August of 2007, Your Honor. He was, again, he self-reported in May, or actually self-reported in April, I apologize. He was sentenced in May of 2005. This court issued its interim suspension order. Please don't hold me to this, but I want to say August 7th. I know it was sometime in early August of 2005. I believe when I reviewed the record, it was August 7th.
So in effect, what you're talking about is the period of time that he was suspended from the practice of law while he was serving it in the penitentiary.
Well, no. Well, also, while he has been released from the penitentiary, Justice O'Donnell, since for the last 15 months. He's here today. His incarceration period was only 5 months. He came back. He was working for those 5 months under home detention. What we're asking for is really held into the law, and we've cited a number of cases, and I'd really like to discuss all of them to show that, in our opinion at least, what Mr. Margolis has done and the way he has reacted to this, and also the fact that we have, and as Justice O'Donnell, as you know, I mean, I've been doing criminal defense work for better than 30 years. I've never seen 30 people stand up and say, we support the person who victimized us. But that, in essence, we have 30 letters. I mean, I know the board said there were some letters, but, you know, realistically, 93 letters were submitted. Lawyers, other members of the community, but 30 of these people were the victims of this antitrust because they know the caliber of this man.
Counsel, that gets to the panel's determination based on your client's testimony at the hearing, that the panel seemed to consider much aggravation based on, I guess, on his testimony. They say they weren't persuaded by the letters. They specifically make that finding, but they make comments about his not accepting responsibility or attempting to explain away the situation. I mean, apparently that's what they believed, as well as some concern about misstating income. Could you elaborate on that a little
bit? Yes, ma'am, I can. First off, it is your role to do a de novo review, which I've already indicated.
How much credit do we give to the fact finder who observed the testimony?
Well, I think if you read the record and the transcript, and I've done that repeatedly, not much, in all honesty. I just don't think they either didn't pay attention or they didn't recite it back appropriately. What happened was, Your Honor, the situation with the panel, Mr. Margolis testified, but I think that if you read the record and you read the testimony, you'll see that it just doesn't match up with the take that was made by the panel. And once again, that flies in the face of everybody else who's reviewed this, including the disciplinary counsel, who found no aggravating circumstances.
Counsel, in that regard, my quick take just on the summary of the, and I have not read the details of his testimony, it seems the panel is saying that this gentleman represented to them that he was just the piano player and didn't know what was going on upstairs. That's sort of their take on this. And then they were further put off by his initial statement that he only made $25,000 a year. That's in their report.
Right. Well, what
when he had a $200,000 bonus.
Well, no. What they did, Your Honor, is they didn't read the record, which said that there's a difference of 12 years between that. What Mr. Margolis testified to is that when he was hired by the Weingold Company, which was owned by his father-in-law, he was practicing law making $28,000 a year. This is 1988 or 1989. That was the testimony we elicited. When the panel asked him, they said, how much money did you make in the year 2000? He said he made over $200,000. Nobody ever questioned that. Okay, so what you have is a complete disconnect. Was there a disparity in his income over the years? Absolutely. He made a lot more money as he stayed with the company. However, the testimony was also clear that there was absolutely nothing based upon company profits to his salary. He was a salaried employee. And again, you know, it was a 12-year difference. So there's a misstatement in there. And if you read the record, it's very, very clear. Now, I didn't go through with him. I don't know if that was a mistake or not. How much did you make every year? I didn't ask him those questions. I was simply trying to show when we were doing the presentation before the panel why it was that Lauren had left the practice of law and had joined the Weingold Company, which was owned by his father-in-law. And one of the reasons was is that he got an immediate increase in salary from $28,000 to $35,000, which you know, it was a 25% increase in, you know, in your compensation package, which I think we can all agree would be something that would at least be tempting if somebody offered you a different job.
What is he doing now?
He is still working for the Weingold Company. The Weingold Company has been sold. He no longer works for his father-in-law. He was given, he's a salesman. That is his job. He does all the sales work, runs the sales department for the company. And he is still working there, and quite frankly, he would like to go back to the practice of law. This is something he wants to do very badly. Of course, he needs to have his license reinstated
Counsel,
in order to do that.
Counsel, the fine assessed here was over $700,000.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was that against your client personally?
Yes, ma'am. There was $700,000 assessed against my client, over $700,000 assessed against his father-in-law, and there was a corporate fine that was in excess of $10 million.
And have all that been satisfied?
Yes, ma'am. Those fines were paid before Mr. Margolis reported to the Department of the United States Department of Justice Department of Corrections. If we look at the cases and we can see, and again, nobody's trying to claim, and I'm very familiar, and I've used with my clients numerous times, this court's comment in State Disciplinary Counsel versus Norris, that a plea of guilty is not a ceremony of innocence. We are not saying that. What Mr. Margolis did do, to get back to you, Justice Lansinger, is that he said there was a question under the law. There was never a question about the facts. His question, and his counsel had told him this, is that we don't know if these facts do equate to a violation. This was after the fact. And all he was doing was saying this was the advice this is what I've been told. Mr. Margolis, while he practiced law for several years, certainly never toiled in the antitrust area. And frankly, I've learned an awful lot about antitrust that I knew nothing about. Since I've become Mr. Margolis' attorney and learned this is a very, very strange area of the law, and a lot of things happen. That doesn't excuse what he did, and it's not saying he doesn't take responsibility or show remorse. What it is saying, and I would hope that we never reach the point that in a courtroom in America, whether it be before the disciplinary council, whether it be before a panel, or this court.
Counsel, antitrust law was not an area of my practice, and we don't see it here. So, flying a little blind myself, but the underlying allegation seems to be that this man and his company and his father-in-law, in conjunction with competitors, got together and agreed who's going to get which deal at a certain price. Now, you don't really need to know much law to know that's probably not permitted.
The question, Your Honor, was...
Wouldn't that strike you without any knowledge of antitrust law? If that was a bar exam question, you'd probably approach it on the basis that that's against the law.
That straight fact alone, I'd agree with you. From what I've seen, there were more nuances here involved in the facts as they were developed, and you have to realize this was a long-term situation. And again, I would defer to all of the lawyers who were involved relative to this.
Other thing that jumped out at me in the what was the stipulations? What was his comment, or I suppose that was submitted that his father-in-law didn't tell him that it was under investigation, or that they had gotten a subpoena. I'm not sure why that accounts for anything.
The question was, is when did you first learn about this? And his answer was, is that the investigation had been ongoing for several years before he had any idea about it. So he was just answering in response to a question. Whether it has anything to do, in your view, Justice Pfeiffer, I can't speak to that. But
well,
the fact
why would
was,
that matter? I mean, if you're breaking the law, knowing that the feds are after you is hardly, or saying I didn't know the feds were after us is hardly a defense, is it?
I'm not saying it was, and nobody did. It was in response to a question that he was asked of, when did you find out about this? That's all.
Did his father-in-law receive a sentence here?
Yes, his father-in-law actually was sentenced for a longer period of incarceration.
What? How long?
He actually was sentenced to 13 months of actual incarceration, where Mr. Margolis was sentenced to a split 5 months in the federal facility and 5 months home detention.
And they were fined the same amount of money, $700,000 each?
His father-in-law was fined the $700,000, and there was a corporate fine to the Weingold Company.
Okay.
And there also was another $9.5 million paid by the Weingold Company in a class action settlement.
Okay.
Mr. Koblenz, the issue here, though, is whether or not the sanction of suspension should be consecutively or concurrently imposed with the interim suspension. Am I right?
Essentially, credit for time served would be the concurrent that you're speaking about, Your Honor, yes.
Is your client presently on home detention or post-release control?
No, sir. He has not been since his home detention terminated in May of 2006, and he has not been under any ban at all under the federal government. His post-release control was terminated by Judge Nugent before it would have been taken up.
Before what?
Before it even commenced. Judge Nugent terminated the post-release control at the conclusion of his home detention, which was supposed to have started afterward. But taking everything into effect, Judge Nugent felt it was appropriate to terminate that post-release control.
Thank you.
Well, I see my time is up and my rebuttal time is gone, but thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate the opportunity to address you.
Ms. Costa.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the panel, Carol Costa on behalf of Disciplinary Counsel. We deferred to the panel's recommendation as to whether or not respondent sanctions should be retroactive to August 2nd of 2005, the date the interim felony suspension began. But we would submit that the evidence in the record supports the board's decision in this case.
What position did counsel take over here?
Sorry.
I don't know why nobody can figure out where I am. My mic doesn't work this way. What position did counsel take going into this at the end of this? What did they recommend to the board?
Counsel asked, respondents counsel. We asked that a two-year suspension be ordered, but we deferred to the panel. That's on 117 of the transcript.
Okay, so you did not make any recommendation on that,
no,
that issue
Honor.
At all?
No, Your Honor.
Were you the party that was trying the case?
Yes.
Because I've read some of the transcripts, and on the bare face of the transcripts, you can definitely put two different interpretations, and you could put, I'm just explaining how I got myself in this mess versus I'm not remorseful. Was there something about his demeanor or his manner of speech that made the panel feel differently? Because on the bare transcript, you can certainly reach either interpretation.
And I think that's what this whole issue boils down to, is the panel's assessment of respondent's veracity and credibility when he was testifying at the hearing. Just as you pointed out in the earlier case, Justice Moyer, when a trial judge looks in a defendant's eyes when he's waiving his rights to a jury, it makes a difference. Here we had three people on this panel looking in the respondent's eyes when he was testifying as to the underlying facts and his history. Three people listened to what the respondent was saying and to how he was saying it.
But you agree with me, do you not, that on the bare words in the transcript, you could go either way?
I think so, but I also think, Your Honor, there are several places in the transcript that clearly support the panel's conclusion and ultimately the board's. We cited an excerpt in our brief of respondent's testimony where he answered a question that one of the panel members asked as to his thoughts on his culpability. And in short, his response was, I kind of feel like the tail of a dog that got dragged along. There's another several pages in the transcripts on page 75 to 77 where a respondent was talking about the legality, or I should say the illegality, of what he was doing. And he basically said, well, yes, I understand there was a law that prohibited this type of conduct, but the law is not clear, nobody understands it, they really should do something about it. I asked him the question because respondent practiced law for 6 years before he got involved in this company. And it wasn't a hand-to-mouth type of practice. It was rather sophisticated. He worked with a real estate firm. They did shopping malls. They did commercial buildings. He testified on pages 57 to 58. He dealt with bond issues, zoning issues, securities, some complex issues. And I asked him, with all your experience in this type of work, how would you feel if some of these contractors you were dealing with did the same thing that you were dealing with? And his testimony was, on page 99 of the transcript, I don't think that would have been appropriate. So he knew what he was doing was wrong. And the way he testified, the panel felt to be condescending, not taking responsibility, and explaining away the facts which are there.
How do you reconcile a panel and the judge's reactions, which seem to be opposite in terms of their reaction to his remorse and his sentencing?
I think, Your Honor, again, it boils down to the trier of fact, in this case the panel, the first adjudicatory level, looking at this individual and making their own assessment as to his veracity. And yes, the trial judge in the federal case thought he had expressed contrition and remorse for his actions. In this case, the panel did not. And I think the difference, too, is the fact that this is not the forum to rehash the charges. The conviction is what it is. The question here is, how is a respondent dealing with, and how does a respondent accept the facts that are what they are? You can have two people who say, I'm sorry, one you believe, one you don't. And in this case, the panel believed he was not remorseful and wasn't accepting responsibility.
So you're, in essence, your interim suspension coupled with no time served is about twice as long as what he got in the criminal case.
It would be more. If you started the suspension now, it would be an additional 2 years. He'd serve virtually no time on suspension, probably, if you put it retroactive back to August 2nd of 2005.
Oh, he served 2 years on suspension.
Right.
If it's right, I mean, he served the 2 years we would normally assess on a suspension.
Right. And I think, too, Your Honor, it's important to look at one of the exhibits that was stipulated to, which is the sentencing transcript, which is Exhibit 4. And the government took a very strong position against respondent in this case. They wanted him to serve 12 months. Their position was, and granted, this was resolved through a plea, but their position was this wasn't something that happened one or two times. This was a regular occurrence that existed for years. The government's investigation went on for 6 to 8 years. They didn't believe that respondent was some naive dupe who was just doing what his father-in-law said to do. Respondent was running this company while father-in-law was in Florida for a good period of time. That was the government's position. Mm-hmm. So we have a variety of different opinions as to what the respondent did and how he felt about it.
Counsel, I noticed in the stipulation there were at least several points in mitigation that were stipulated to. There were no aggravating points that were stipulated to. In the panel's conclusion that none of the letters submitted should be were persuasive, would you comment on that?
I think, and I know the court has addressed this in other disciplinary matters, I think that character letters have their place. But, and I know that in Exhibit 4, when Judge Nugent was discussing the sentencing, the same letters were presented to him. And he made mention of the fact that, well, Mr. Margolis, you're a lawyer. You all know we can get people to write whatever you like. I certainly think that the panel in this case and the board looked at those letters and they considered them. But again, I think the overwhelming evidence that the panel relied on in making their decision was their assessment of respondents' credibility and veracity. It's just like when a reviewing court is looking at the decision of a trial judge who has made a determination as to a witness's or party's credibility. There's a wealth of case law out there that says that trial judge is in the best position because they were there, they saw it, they heard it firsthand. And it's uncommon for a decision based on that type of decision to be overturned because that trier of fact was there and heard everything directly. And that's what we're saying here. The record supports, we believe, what the panel and the board ultimately decided to do, and we see no reason to argue against it.
Counsel, I had a couple of questions for the respondent's attorney regarding the stipulation. My father-in-law didn't tell me that we were under investigation. And also the knowledge that the conduct was probably illegal. The flip side to that would be putting yourself in the respondent's shoes. I think it is true, at least it is the reputation, the federal government, that the federal government's enforcement of the antitrust laws has had a pretty checkered immediate past. Aggressive enforcement, I think under Reagan, there were people who thought there was no such thing as antitrust, and so almost a withdrawal from enforcement. And I don't know where we are now. Obviously, more aggressive than they were at some point in time. So the laws were on the books, but during maybe even some of this history, federal government wasn't enforcing, and perhaps the reason he's saying that is, gee, if I'd known that they were taking a look at this, we would have ended these practices, which we knew were probably illegal, but probably, you know, his attitude might have been, well, they're not enforcing this, so we can do it even though it's illegal, or we've finessed this so that we think it's on the borderline of legal and illegal.
I think, Your Honor, any defendant could say that. Gee, if I had known that, I wouldn't have done what I did. But I think there's a difference when you have a felony conviction type of case here between somebody who says, you know, I never thought about it. Oh, my gosh, if I had thought for 2 seconds, I would have known something was wrong. I'm sorry. This isn't going to happen again. I've learned my lesson. I apologize to the court, my profession, period. As opposed to someone saying, yes, I knew there were laws, but they're not clear, and everybody did it, and well, maybe if I had thought about it. And I think it's a subjective evaluation on the part of the panel, but nevertheless, an evaluation that they're entitled to make as the first level of adjudication in this type of process.
The letters that were mentioned, that 30 letters from people who were victims of this scheme, would those people be folks that the respondent is still dealing with in his present employment capacity?
That I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know. And I'm not sure exactly how extensive the business currently is after the incarceration and all of the problems. And I'm sure, and I'm not even sure, I know that this particular case garnished a lot of attention in this particular industry. So I don't know if that changed things or not. Therefore, based on the evidence that was presented and the panel's firsthand opportunity to listen to the respondent, we would submit that the recommendation made by the board before the court is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Costa. Mr. Koblenz, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, in a nutshell, I think that we just asked the court to go back and look at other cases, the precedent that exists, where people who have violated federal law have been given credit for time served. I would also just want to stress the idea that we do have a panel report, but on the other hand, we had a whole lot of other folks who looked at all this activity, and we don't believe that asking for credit for time served is overreaching in this case. Mr. Margolis has recognized what he did was wrong and certainly did apologize for that, and we would certainly ask for the court's consideration in view of all the precedent and the law relative to this matter and issue the appropriate sanction of credit for time, a 2-year suspension with credit for time served. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.